Well, it may seem like once the cold and the snow hits, there aren't many insects topics to cover. But you're wrong. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri with us today. There's always something to talk about in the world of insects. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. It's always great to have Phil with us. He's entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, formerly head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, great to have you back. Thank
you.
Nice
to be here.
Happy New Year.
Same to you.
And as you listen to Phil and I talk, I hope you'll join in. Did you notice some trends in insect populations in 2014? Anything more plentiful than usual or say maybe fewer numbers than usual? You have a picture, a photo of an insect that you'd like to help us identify, or maybe just a cool insect photo. I'd love to hear that or see that as well on our Facebook page. Go to the Facebook page for the photos. The Larry Mueller Show is the title of our program's Facebook page. You can phone us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Here we are at the end of 2014, Phil. Insect trends that stand out to you this past year?
Well, you know, every year I kind of come up with a top 10. But if I take a step back and look at just the general trends, this was as quiet a year for agricultural pests that I've ever seen in my career.
Wow. And
it's right across the board, whether you talk soybeans, alfalfa. And you can't explain it on any one weather phenomenon because some of these insects migrate up here. Some of them spend the winter. You know, there definitely does seem to be with European corn borer, the use of genetically modified corn has absolutely, I mean, it's the lowest population we've seen in 73 years. And this has been a 10-year trend of that non-native insect population being dramatically dropped down. The corn rootworm, which is an insect that is the most significant insect for farmers in continuous corn, its numbers are really quite low. And again, we are seeing more genetically modified corn out there. And one has to speculate that that is having some part of this impact. But things like potato leafhopper that migrate up here in the spring, even though they got up here in early May, they really just never took off. You know, the heavy rains of June slowed down some of the aphids and as I said, right across the board, there was nothing that really in the agricultural sector had a good year, if you want to think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. You know, always interesting things. There was an insect that we give the common name copper underwing, and it's a type of cutworm moth that, you know, we always see a few out there. They were everywhere this fall, you know, and it's not something that we consider a pest, but this is the one that some of the mail carriers, I probably had the problem every time they opened a mailbox, about six of them would come fluttering out. They were getting in people's houses. So they said something unprecedented. I've never saw those numbers, you know, in my years of chasing insects. And it's just kind of fun sometimes to sit and look at these things. And as I said, some of these things are once every 40, 50 year phenomena.
Yeah, very interesting. What about emerald ash borer?
Yeah, you know, the unfortunate thing is we added a number of counties with positive records now, and, you know, a good half the state is in one form or another quarantined. You know, it gains momentum. And, you know, a lot of cases where you found it for the first time, you know, the numbers are low. People aren't seeing dead trees. But if you fast forward 5 or 6 years from now in those local hot spots, you're going to start to see significant diebacks. So, you know, as we had talked about, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, it was really staying kind of quiet, and you kind of got this feeling, well, maybe we'll luck out here, but no. You know, it just seems to be that, as I said, much as the trend, and about the only thing we've got going for us here is we've had some time, I think, to adjust. You know, city foresters have been able to come up with plans on how they're going to deal with it, and then for people in their own front yards, you know, unlike the people in Michigan, where years into the infestation here, at least for high value trees, you can start doing something to preserve those individual trees.
Yeah. At the city of Madison, as an example, I believe is identifying trees that want ash trees it wants to save, and they're going to save those and the street trees. And then the others are going to come down probably.
Yeah, definitely. And as I said, so even Madison's example, you know, we really haven't seen a lot of mortality yet. We're a ways away from it, but this gives people some chance to make some good decisions, some common sense decisions on some of these.
Yeah. What about Japanese beetles?
God, were they quiet.
Yeah, I can't remember us really talking about them.
No, and it's, You know, it's kind of two things I think were involved with this. The significant drought in much of the state in 2013 definitely knocked their numbers down. But, you know, I always go back to the issue is that these are significant insect problems on golf courses. Golf courses, because of their irrigation, don't have drought issues. And, you know, in the west side of Madison, where I live, you know, 10 years ago, it was kind of a science fiction experience to deal with those insects. And last year, you know, I'm not saying I couldn't find them, but it was maybe 5% of the population at its peak.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the general trend, is that in communities where it's relatively new, the numbers will go up for a while. But after 5 or 6 years of just real bad problems, it seems to start to level out. And you know, can we have a weather pattern that will bring some of them back? Yes. But, you know, the general feeling with these invasives sometimes is they're usually the biggest nightmare early in their invasion, and they tend to come into somewhat of a balance over time. And it's just a question of, will that balance be acceptable to us, or will it be problematic? But, yeah, it was a down year, and I can't blame that all on the drought, as I said, in many of the areas, because there are microenvironments that did not have drought issues, and the beetles weren't doing well there.
Yeah, I actually, you know, 3 years ago or 4 years ago, we had tons of them on, you know, we had grapes growing along an entire wall on our driveway, and they were covered probably 4 years ago. And this year, I hardly saw any. I mean, there were just very few.
Well, you know, in watching this infestation in Madison, because Madison was one of the first communities to really have significant populations, I always explained it was like a donut. Is that the outer edges of the donut where the heavy populations, they continue to expand, and the center collapsed. Mm. And that has been the trend that I have witnessed in my career, and hopefully that will continue. But the unfortunate side, as I said, people who have not seen that insect, it's coming. So
Dana in Amaro has a question. So let's go to Dana. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. So I have a couple of high-value ash trees that really help me reduce my air conditioning bill in the summer. And for 2 years, we've been treating them with a root drench by Bayer that was recommended mm-hmm. to forestall any ash borer infestation. But I also read that woodpeckers eat the emerald ash borer larvae and might actually be useful in controlling any infestation that might happen. And so that's my first question, is that true? And second, I've got woodpecker feeders up now, and they are pecking on the ash trees and making some wounds, small wounds in the bark. Am I creating an entryway for ash borer with my woodpecker experiment?
Okay, good questions. It turns out that the studies I have seen suggest that the level of chemicals in the larvae should not be toxic to the birds.
Uh-huh. You know, so that's a good thing.
That's a good thing. The other side of it is ash borer is not necessarily associated with wounds as far as access. It just attacks an ash because it's there. So I really don't think so. In fact, woodpeckers take a large percentage of ash borers out of the environment. So it would be far worse without the benefit of their feeding. Unfortunately, they don't take them all. But it's interesting, in heavily infested areas, one of the quickest ways to identify a tree that's infested is by the amount of woodpecker feeding up on the top of the tree.
Oh.
You often see that feeding before you even start to see decline in the tree.
Interesting.
And so it said, especially in woodlot situations, that's what foresters and whatnot often use is a quick mechanism in these areas where we've seen problems. Or again, if you see a lot of woodpecker feeding, it's well worth poking at a little bit deeper to see if you see any more significant in confirmation type signs of activity.
Well, we've never had them on the property until I put up winter feeders with suet, so I guess I brought them here. I'm going to keep them.
Yes,
keep
definitely.
Keep them there, Dana. Thanks a lot. And Happy New Year. Appreciate the call.
You too, guys.
Bye. Mark in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
There's some, I think we call them pulse flies. I'm not really sure what kind of a bug it is. It's an exterior outdoor bug. And it comes out on warmer days, late winter, sometimes late autumn, early winter. And what happens to them? Can these things live through multiple freezing cycles? And is this just like one time out and then they die? Or mm-hmm. are there multiple populations that come out on each warm day? What's the life cycle of them?
Well, most likely, without seeing it, but a fly that would fit that pattern is something that we call a cluster fly, and it's a interesting animal. It's a non-native parasitic fly of earthworms, and its habit is to migrate into sheltered sites in the fall and then wake up, if all things are normal, in the spring when it warms up, and then continue on its way. So it overwinters as an adult. These are the ones that come into people's homes, and they're often referred to as winter flies, among other things, because every warm day, a few seem to wake up in the attic and come down in the house and bother. And the flies that do that, we find, die very quickly because they're on pretty low energy reserves in the warmth that causes them to use up that energy or metabolically burn out, means they die pretty quickly. What's quite interesting about this, you'd think that if you finally got yourself in this kind of hibernation state, you'd stay there. But they don't. It's kind of like turning a light on and off. And although even it seems like a risky decision to wake up and fly around for 3 or 4 hours on the a warm day in December, they do that. And so if I had to guess, and typically as it starts to cool down, they'll find a crack in the bark of a tree or up underneath the siding of your house and tuck themselves underneath it. And then they just seem to do just fine. And as I said, they will kind of ebb and flow. And in a warm environment, if you get the temperature above about 40 degrees where they are hiding, they seem to wake up. They look very much like a housefly. Underneath a microscope, they have these very distinctive golden hairs that remind me of corn silk, very fine hairs. And so they're pretty easy to identify with a magnifying glass, but you need that kind of magnification to be able to verify it is a cluster fly.
Interesting.
So what's their bioenergetics like? I mean, how are they able to, what kind of reserve do they have that they're able to come back out of hibernation several times without using up their stored energy?
Well, no, as I said, I think it's a little bit foolish, although I don't think they burn themselves out quite as much outdoors where metabolically they're still kind of slowed down being cold-blooded. So in other words, the cooler it is, the less energy they're burning. But indoors where they're experiencing 65 and 70 degrees, which is very unnatural, has to be really very, very tough on them. As I said, typically when you see one flying around the living room, within a day or two, you find it dead on the windowsill. And we think it's just, as I said, it just burns itself out and nothing to feed on, no way of adding new food reserves, and that's it.
There we go. Thanks a lot. Thanks. Mark.
Yep. Bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri about significant insect trends in 2014, among other things. And again, I think we've got one open line. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You should go to our Facebook page if you have a chance. If you're at the computer, go to our Facebook page. The title is The Larry Mueller Show. That's our Facebook page. And look at some of the photos that we've got up already. To find those photos, the left side of the page, there's something that says posts to page or something like that. And you can, post to page, and you can just click on that, and the photos will show up. And Phil, Cheryl sent us.
Sure. So the first photo is a family that we call the leaf-footed bugs. And what allows me to identify it is the name implies the last pair of legs often have a flange or flaring. And in some of the tropical species, it is just amazing how big it is. And so, again, it looks like a leaf. It probably helps it age it in camouflage. The most common leaf-footed bug we get is called the western conifer seed bug, and it comes into people's homes at times. This is a different critter, and these little spike-like projections up on the prothorax is what tells me it's a different species of leaf-footed bug. And I want to say Acanthocephalus, but I'm not 100% sure on that genus. Okay. But they're a woodland creature. They feed on various plants with their sucking mouth part, so it's a plant-feeding insect. And interesting enough, this is an insect that I didn't see very much early in my career. I see it more often now, and I equate this to being kind of one of those a little more common southern insects that are seeming to be more common here. And, that's more gut feeling. I don't have a lot of science to base that on, but it's been my observation, as I always thought that this was more of an Illinois bug, but it's seeming to become more commonplace in Wisconsin.
And here's another one. She sent a second
Yeah, so this looks like an orb weaver spider. And the banding of the legs in particular is quite common of this family. And then this large marble-like abdomen that is often highly colored in contrasting colors. And so, as I said, it looks like a marble. Very common in the late summer. These are the ones that make those beautiful webs that you see the dew collecting on in the mornings. The females, again, will get the size of a nickel as far as their abdomen. And one of the things is they're great photographic subjects because they're usually very colorful. A bit of a stinker to identify the species because there's quite a bit of variability within even a given species. They have oranges versus yellows versus reds and the like. And so I can't tell you the species, but as I said, that banding of the legs takes me there very quickly, and then that large abdomen, and looks scary but are very harmless.
We have Tom in Black River Harbor in the UP of Michigan up next. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning. Say, you touched on the cluster fly. I believe that's what I'm speaking of. I live right on the south shore of Lake Superior. And June, most of July, and some often parts of August, will get inundated with not thousands of what we call cluster flies, but literally tens and twenties of thousands. Mm-hmm. Right along the shore where if you stand outside, for 10 seconds, they will cluster on you in the hundreds. And I know mm-hmm. this sounds like I'm exaggerating. I'm not. So you open the door and 20, 30 fly in. Mm-hmm. So what we've tried to do over the years is try to predict when they're going to be there and just you have to leave. You can't be there. Mm-hmm. You can't go outside. It's even tough being inside. And it appears that they like real warm temperatures, high humidity, and maybe a breeze coming from the south. But one day there's maybe 100,000 in the yard, and then the next day every single one is gone. And 3 days later, they might come back again.
Okay.
It's like a horror movie.
Okay. Well, the first thing is, if it was cluster flies in the neighborhood, I would expect your peak activity to be the spring and the fall, not the summer. Flies are a real difficult creature to identify because everything kind of looks the same. So if you ever get a chance to find a few dead ones, I'd send it down to the diagnostic lab and PJ can take a look. But I give you my speculation here, and this even goes to some of the biting fly problems we've seen along Lake Superior. You mentioned southerly winds, and we see a lot of insects migrating, and when they run into the cooling effect of the lake, they just stop right on the lakeshore. And so that leads me to believe it could be a number of things that are coming in. There are face flies. I'm not even sure. So it would be interesting both, you know, just to give a more solid answer to know exactly which one it is. But I think that's it.
Maybe there'll be like, 30 seconds. There might be 10 or 20 that all cluster up on your jeans or mm-hmm. they make little piles.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting, and this would be more of a yo-yo, you know, large numbers then disappear. They're up in your part of the country when we've had outbreaks of forest tent caterpillar. The year or two after that, we get an outbreak of what are called friendly flies, and that's their modus of operandi. They land on people, and they don't bite. They don't do anything. They just hang out. But their numbers are very tied into tent caterpillars, and so when the populations crash of tent caterpillars, within a year or two, the population of friendly flies. And if this has been a reoccurring annual problem, it cannot be that species because it wouldn't fit that pattern. But as I said, it may be worth just trying to get...
Shouldn't be any problem collecting some.
Yeah, and you know, try to send them in a way that they don't get crushed too much because PJ is going to need to have them in pretty decent shape to give you an idea. But then maybe we can at least give a little bit better explanation of who it is and why it's there. But said, we know for a fact that the lakeshore has some interesting aspects, and we think it's temperature related. And your observation about the southerly airflows having something to do with it really would fit that pattern too.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Tom. I want to give John in Janesville a chance to join us. He's been waiting a bit here. John, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Over the weekend, I was at the UW Entomology Department website. I'm actually thinking of being an entomologist, but another story. I saw that on the website, one of the headlines was the Lone Star Tick and mm-hmm. how it's starting to creep into Wisconsin. And then just some other information, I saw that ticks are kind of moving all around North America. The deer tick is creeping out to North Dakota. And I keep reading about more and more diseases being found in ticks. So it seems to be an emerging trend, and it's going to cause more problems for us. Wondering why. We're starting to get Lone Star ticks here. What's driving these trends?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I think most of us feel it's climate-related. You know, it's interesting as I'm sitting kind of trying to get a book written about some things that I experienced in my career, going through old records. So historically, I would see a couple Lone Star ticks. And we always used to write that off to migrants that would be coming up here on birds, but that we're not establishing. But my colleague Susan Paskowitz and her students pretty much convinced us about 4 or 5 years ago with what they were finding in areas when they were sampling. And they're doing deer tick research, but they were finding Lone Star ticks that were breeding in the state. And we have equated that really with a lack of cold weather. And so one of the things I was really quite interested in with the previous winter being, you know, an old-fashioned, cold, nasty winter, would that knock the populations down or eliminate it? I don't think we saw anything to say that the trends were the populations of deer tick or Lone Star ticks were up, but we definitely caught more Lone Star ticks again. And so they're still breeding in the state. And as I said, I don't expect that to change. The deer tick, you know, this has been an unfolding story in the last 30, 40 years. And the research suggests to us is that what we know for a fact that the deer tick populations were wiped out during the Ice Age because we didn't have any deer. We didn't have proper habitat. Somehow they were reintroduced. I'm sure they migrated on birds and other things, but they needed everything to fall in place to get breeding populations. And we can only trace back the breeding population in Wisconsin to 1969 when one of the graduate students in our department was doing a mouse in parasite study, and he found a deer tick and he published on it. First time the tick had ever been found, and it's typically more of a southern tick. And what they can tell now is that these populations up here are genetically not as diverse as the native populations of deer ticks down in Texas. So this all supports that premise that it was reintroduced. But what people felt had to be one of the dynamics to allow it to take off is to get to a certain deer density. And so that when the deer populations were very low, it wasn't the right conditions to allow the deer ticks to establish. But as in the last 50 years, deer populations are definitely higher than they were historically. That seems to be one of the factors. And then we slowly see this moving out. So we've seen it migrate into Illinois, and slowly it's moving into Ohio. But ticks, you almost would think would spread quicker. Not because they can crawl very far, but because when they're on their hosts, especially birds, of course, they can be carried large distances.
Yeah.
But we're definitely seeing those trends, and the more we study this, the interesting side is ticks are extremely efficient at picking up rodent diseases because they often feed on various kinds of rodents when they're immature. And unfortunately, some of those diseases can be transmitted to people if they feed on you later in their life cycle. And so that's what we continue to find. The more they look, the more rodent diseases seem to be popping up. And some of these are having problems. And, you know, it seems every 2 or 3 years we're coming up with a new one. In fact, the last one I don't even think has got an official name yet, the one that was discovered up in the Eau Claire area. So the trends would suggest exactly that is range expansions, probably related to climate to some degree. And then again, don't be surprised that as people continue to study this, we'll find that there are more organisms that they are bridging from the rodents into humans.
Yeah, there we go. John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Had a Facebook question from, my friend Inga Wisher, who wonders what happens to dung beetles in the winter. Where do they go?
So if I had to guess, because dung beetles is a pretty big subgroup of scarab beetles, but the way most of them work is that their larvae are feeding on the debris that the parents have buried or that the larvae have pulled down into their chambers. So they're in the ground, probably as larvae or in some cases pre-pubi. And then when the weather warms up, they will transform into adults and then go from there. So very well sheltered. You can see that that's a good strategy to get through the winter because you're really protected from an awful lot of the extremes that are out there. And as I said, many of the scarab beetles seem to overwinter as larvae. And so this would fit just exactly into what seems to be a common trend for that family.
Leanne would like to join us, so let's go to Leanne. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I listen all the time to you. See, recently we've had a situation, or it's actually been over the last 3 years, state-certified arborist Dave Venske was called in on a situation with Sherrod County for the Mount Morris Parkway. There were a couple small isolated spots of oak wilt, and it's been clear cut for the sake of this little bit of oak wilt. And it was explained by him that it does, like white oak can survive it, although red oak does not. However, it doesn't always travel further than that. Like a couple little sections may be taken out by the oak wilt, but then they Mother Nature kind of recaps on everything, and then it'll go on and not necessarily take all the red oak in around that area. Can you explain to everyone what the life cycle is on the beetles that are that are responsible for that?
Sure. Well, there's two parts of the story, and that's what I think complicates it for some people. Now, the organism that kills the tree is a fungus. And the fungus can get into the tree one of two ways. One is through the roots, where roots are touching each other, and it's spread that way. And that's where you get these pockets of oak wilt that get bigger and bigger over time and have nothing to do with the insects. Now, the question is, how did it get there to begin with? And that's where the insects come to play. So there's a whole family of sap beetles or picnic beetles. They're given those common names. We have a number of species in the state. They're normally associated with fermenting, overly ripe things, and some of them live under the bark of trees. And in particular, what seems to happen is some of the species will get under the bark of a dead or dying oak that's filled with the fungus. They pick up the spores on their body. And then what they're attracted to is wound sites. And so if there is a tree that's wounded, they go show up. They're feeding on the saps that are coming out. That's hence the name of the beetle family. And, oh, by the way, they're contaminated, so the spores now have a place to become infective and move out. And so that's why most communities in the state have rules about cutting oak trees during the growing season when the insects are active. Now, some communities will basically say at no time when the temperatures are above 40 degrees. So we're going like the 1st of April till the 1st of November and the like. The science suggests that really oak wilt is more of a spring and early summer, that when you get into late summer, it's less of a problem because the fungus is not in an infective stage. But I think most people err on the side of doing anything you can to preserve those trees. So this is the one case that after storm damage in an area in the summer, that arborists often will come in and they will use tree paints and other things on the wound sites and clean that stuff up so that we have less places to attract the beetles. But picnic beetles are everywhere. They're always out there. You know, so there's no way you can control the picnic beetles per se. But then when you understand what the dynamic is that they're attracted to wound sites. You want to prevent any wound sites or do whatever you can to take those out of the picture during the summer. And then once a tree becomes infected, then, as I said, then you have to worry about if there are adjacent trees that may have root contact. And that's why they kind of clear cut or will cut pockets or they do various kind of root pruning and other things so that they try to stop that kind of spread with oak wilt.
Yeah. And those beetles, I know there's been research, and you may have talked about it before, but where the researchers have actually wounded a tree and within almost seconds.
Yeah,
there's a beetle there.
You know, as I said, they're really quite common, and thank goodness that there's not many situations where everything falls in place where you get these infective situations. So the beetle's got to hang out somewhere that's got spores and then has to be attracted to a tree that has a wound site to get this all working. So as I said, that's the part. And you'd be amazed how many picnic beetles are flying around there. I mean, you know, there's one group of these that are quite common problems for strawberry people that, you know, when the berries get a little overly ripe, the picnic beetles come in. That species has some orange dots on kind of a brownish body, so they're pretty easy to identify. But there's many other species. So all you got to do is take something like a fermenting banana, put it in a little soapy water out in a dish, and you'll be amazed at the number of picnic beetles that show up. And as I said, that's what they're attracted to, is that vinegary fermenting type smell. And that's what's going on in the dead and dying trees underneath the bark.
Sure.
You know, so that's what draws them in and is how they become infected.
There you go.
Small interested group had brought Dave in, and he said, too, that all the trees didn't need to be removed for this. It should have been more managed by a forester of some sort.
Yeah, and a lot of times in woodlots, you know, trained foresters will come in and kind of mark what they think needs to be removed and not to try to. It's kind of like putting out a fire is the best way to put it. And I would say in many cases, clear cutting seems to be kind of the extreme.
Yeah.
And as I said, interesting enough, now, it's not that white oaks will not die. but they often can recover, whereas it seems that red oaks just don't have that good a defense. And so more often than not, when a red oak is infested, it's you're going to lose the tree.
Yeah, there we go.
And is it wrong to leave a stand of trees like that? Because I know others that do have stands of trees that have been affected by it, but they're choosing not to take them down.
Well, you know, I mean, eventually the tree dies to the point that the fungus is not growing there. So, you know, it can be so far gone that it is not infective. But I think what the argument and concern is that two things, is that this pocket will continue to expand on its own unless there's some kind of management done or it runs to a place where there's no more root contact. And the other side is that the more trees that are infested, the more fungus that's being produced, the more you increase the probability of transmission. And so, now, again, in some big woodlots, it might not be economically feasible to do it, but it gets, as I said, to just ignore it without getting some kind of professional consult, to me, seems quite risky.
Yeah, absolutely. Leanne, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had a question from Jeff. Said he saw some small black spiders, or a small black spider, I should say, about a centimeter in size on top of the snow in Ironwood, Michigan. Temperature is about 30. How common is it to see a spider in those conditions? What type might it have been?
Probably more common than people think. I think most people who are walking around at 30 degrees don't think of insects or spiders being active. But the president of the Wisconsin Ant Society is a gentleman by the name of Kyle Johnson. And Kyle is entomologist. He's an entomologist to an entomologist. I mean, Kyle thrives on going out in the middle of the winter at the coldest day in finding insect activity, and be darned he does. And so which spider it is, a little hard to say. You know, my first inclination is dark spiders that are moving around are jumping spiders. But they often live for 2 or 3 years, so they could be in the adult stage, but it could be somebody else. And I think what's a little bit key here is their dark body. Because the trick here is they have to get their body temperature up. And if you are a dark-bodied creature sitting on the south side of a tree in a good sunny day, you can absorb enough heat that you become active, is what it is. So you'd be less likely to see this on a cloudy day and the like. And again, you know, much like the earlier conversation we had, it seems like a dumb thing for an animal to do is to wake up when there's not going to be anything to eat and the like. But that seems just to be the way they're programmed. As I said, it there's more things out there than I think people realize. It's just that you got to kind of get your nose down to the ground to see what's moving around.
Paul in Oshkosh has a question. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I moved to Oshkosh about 20 years ago, and I live right on Lake Winnebago. Before I moved here, I'd never heard of lake flies, and I was just wondering if they're that specific to Lake Winnebago or if they're found other places. People I've talked to that don't live around here have never heard of them before, but they, about around Mother's Day every year, they come out for about a week or two and they're just swarms of them.
Yeah.
Right. So lake fly to an entomologist literally is a group of 100+ different species. In fact, a few hundred different species of insects that must live in water as larvae. Many of them are little red worms. But there's one species in particular that is very famous. It's Chironomys plumosa, and that's the one that bothers you up in Lake Winnebago. It's a relatively big lake fly, as lake flies go. They're quite common in shallower, somewhat warm water lakes. So you don't see this. You have to have the right kind of water conditions. And the interesting thing, even though there is a long history of lake flies in Lake Winnebago, I remember as a graduate student, one of my professors had been studying quite some time the problems. But honestly, the lake flies in the last 20 years, their populations dove, and you know they were far less common a problem, which was not normal. That got people very concerned about what was going on environmentally. Now they seem to be coming back. Which would suggest that the water quality is getting better. I know people feel that this is very important for sturgeon populations and other things that are in the ecology of the lake. But unfortunately, if you live next to the lake, when you get this mass emergence of adults, it is absolutely mind-boggling. You know, we're talking inches deep of insects and, you know, people develop allergies to them and you pray that the wind is going so the people on the other side of the shore gets them instead of you. But they said it's something that it's kind of, if you haven't experienced it, it's hard to explain it to a level that people would appreciate how bad it is. But as I said, so the general trend is their numbers have been coming back in the last 10 years plus, which many people feel is a good sign for the health of the lake. But unfortunately, it means a major nuisance. But we have lake fly problems down at Lake Koshkonong in Wisconsin. If you do a search on lake flies, there are many communities. Out in California, there's a number of communities that have a similar type of problem. But as I said, it has to do with really the lake environment. And what's rather common is this relatively shallow, relatively speaking, warm water lakes seem to be the most prone to this particular species.
Mm. Sure. Yeah. Well, that would make sense. I know Lake Winnebago is a big lake, but generally pretty shallow.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Christopher in Verona, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. So my fiance and I, we're pretty nature-loving folk. We don't, things don't wig us out too much, but we've got this problem with, from photos on the internet, it looks like a house centipede, all those little mm-hmm. legs and things like that just wig us out. And
sure.
We're just wondering, is there a natural way or a non-pesticide way of controlling them?
Sure. Well, at least reducing. So the first thing is that this is a tropical species. So you don't generally expect to find it outdoors, but the environments that we have indoors have allowed it in. People move them when they move physical objects. So it's quite common, and they're predators. And so the first thing is that you never expect to find 20 in a day because there isn't enough food to support them. But because they live in walls and attics and the like, no matter what you would do, I would have no faith in anything that somebody said, well, I will eliminate them, eradicate them from your house. But to try to keep the numbers down, they seem to like things a little bit damper. They like clutter just because there's places to hide. But what I often suggest as a control method is to buy these glue boards. They're basically just a sticky cardboard trap. There are versions that are used for rodent control. We use versions like this to monitor insect problems in the house. And so if you get some of these glue boards and you put them down in the basement or underneath the refrigerator, kind of places out of the way, and especially if you got pets or kids, you got to keep them out of the way because you don't want the kids to get stuck on the glue boards. But what happens is when the centipede runs across, it gets captured and it will die. And you're basically removing, many cases, adults out of the population. And when you remove an adult, that is going to slow the reproduction. So as I said, I find that maybe a little bit of habitat modification, but putting the glue boards out will help you knock them down. There's this misconception that they come through drains. And what's happening is when they're out looking for food at night, they often will fall into a tub or a sink and they can't crawl out. And so you get, you know, them stuck there. And that's, as I said, a lot of times. The other thing you notice is, and what it does creep people out, is the minute they see a light on or see any activity, they scurry. I mean, they're just amazing how fast they are. And they like to run underneath things because that's typically what centipedes will do, is hide underneath things. And then they are nighttime predators that go out and forage for food.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll get to Barb and McQuanago in just a second, but a reminder here, we're talking insects of note in 2014 and answering your insect questions with Phil Pelletieri. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, talking insects in 2014 and beyond, probably into 2015. And you can join us with your questions, comments, or experiences. If you have photos, I hope you'll post them on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have a bunch more that I'm looking at right now that are pretty cool, and we'll talk about them in a minute or two. The Facebook page is, again, The Larry Mueller Show. If you want to call in, the number is 1-800-642-1234. Or email at talk@wpr.org. Barb in McGuanago has been waiting quite a while. Barb, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, back to the tick issue, we're in southeast Wisconsin, and we've been working really hard on eradicating our invasive buckthorn and honeysuckle. And one of the benefits I've found is a lot fewer ticks. And I'm wondering if there's any correlation there between especially the honeysuckle and fewer ticks.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the change of the environment at the soil surface, and you're basically drying things out because you're opening it up, and that's not good for ticks. You know, we find that ticks do well down in litter, and they need some moisture. So shady conditions with, you know, Lots of leaf litter is good for them, and anything you do to open things up and dry them out. So there are studies, especially with the deer tick, seeing what microenvironments and habitat effects have. And as I said, it just comes down as simple as the more you can open things up and the drier it gets, the more the ticks have problems in it.
Excellent.
Now, it also, you know, part of that fits into that is that, you know, there's this rodent association. So the same thing, you know, I think as you get mice and other things more exposed to predators, there's less of them, which means there's less food for the tick. So, I mean, it's more complicated than just light source, but it definitely is what you would expect. As you open things up, the ticks aren't going to be happy.
Good for you, Barb. Thanks. Appreciate the call. Dick in Oconomowoc. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. A half box elder tree question, half insect related question.
Okay.
I've got a wrong placed, very large box elder. I'm planning on girdling it this winter, so it'll have just modest, if any, growth this spring before it dies. Is there any insect related reason I need to take that tree down this year, or am I okay letting that be just a natural deadfall, you know, for a couple of years?
Yeah, no, there's no problem. In fact, if anything, you should have, depending how many other box elder trees are in the neighborhood, it will lessen the food for box elder bug breeding, which they like it hot and dry. So, you know, they have good years and bad years. You know, eventually there will be wood borers that move into it, but none of them that I, you know, box elder's not the tree you got to get out of there in a year, or it's going to fall down because of the insect activity. So no, I don't think of anything that I would be concerned about that would be breeding in the dead tree.
There you go.
Excellent. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. And Lori in Dodgeville. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I am desperate. I have a room upstairs that's closed off all year long. We use it maybe once or twice, and it has a couple crawl spaces. But a couple times a year, that room fills up with probably 100 flies. Where are they coming from?
They're coming from either the attic space or the wall voids. And this is that cluster fly that, you know. And so about the only thing, you've got two solutions. One of them, the time is not good. I mean, for people who have had a history of these problems, the first thing we try to see is figure out where they're coming in from, because sometimes it is an attic vent that's not screened properly or other kinds of openings that they can squeeze through. And if you can seal that up and they can't get any more, we got it solved. But they're already in your walls now. Yeah, so the one thing that you might look at is using tape or maybe caulk, but I would look around the light fixtures. I would look around the electrical outlets. I would look at heating vents. I would look at the door to the crawl space and see if you could tape those, because somehow they're squeezing into that room. And if you can physically keep them in the walls and then when they wake up, they leave. But it's mind-boggling, I think, in the right circumstance, how many flies are really squeezing in. I mean, I've seen them in attic spaces where they're 3 inches deep. You know, especially old farmhouses and whatnot that have a lot of leaky places. And as I said, when things warm up, they kind of wake up and they're attracted to light. So that's why they're squeezing through the hole cut in the ceiling to put a light fixture in. Or, as I said, I've seen them from electrical outlets, any kind of opening. There's a space in a baseboard. If the windows don't sit just quite right in the wall, and again, and we're talking small seams. I mean, something about an eighth of an inch in length is enough for them to squeeze through. But as I said, if you can solve that, and even if it's just putting masking tape, it doesn't need to be much, but you may be able to at least alleviate the problem in that room, and then look down, you know, next spring and kind of look at that side corner of the house up high to see if you can find, and especially check your soffits, your overhangs. Because what I find is the flies are often in the fall crawling upwards. And when they get to that soffit, if there's a seam that they can crawl up underneath, or there's a vent that's not screened properly, it's like having a hole in your wall, and they just come piling in. And then, as I said, they'll filter their way into other parts of the house as the winter progresses.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Lori, for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. If you go to our Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you're going to find even more photos of insects and other things as well. Actually, Tom has a photo here of some grubs in a white pine that he cut and split last fall in Rhinelander.
Sure. So the thing that I'm guessing here is size reference. But if I see a white pine that has huge grubs, and we're talking holes that are the diameter of a pencil, if not bigger.
Okay.
There's an animal we call the pine sawyer beetle. It's a long-haired wood-boring beetle. It attacks dead and dying pines. It takes upwards of 2 years to go through a life cycle, but it creates huge grubs, also very noisy grubs. You can literally hear them chewing in a stack of firewood or a standing tree.
Oh, boy.
The confusion is that often when you see the grubs, the tree is in some form of decline, if not death. You're inclined to blame these insects, but the reality is they're moving in after the tree has died or is dying from something else. So they're kind of a secondary thing. So they don't harm anything. They create a very large 2-inch-long beetle with great big long antennae. It looks very scary, but that's nothing to worry about. But the only problem we have with them is people that make log homes out of white pine that have the beetles in the logs when they build a house. These things sometimes take 4 to 5 years to come out in those conditions. So you got something make a noise in the wall, and it will leave you a great big hole that you're going to have to patch. But that's the worst of it. They cannot reinfest standing wood or any wood in your house. So it's not as if you're going to get a infection or, you know, a problem, an established population. But they're impressive insects. The other thing, if you look at the adult, the white pine sawyer is the most common of the three species we see here. They look almost identical to the Asian longhorn beetle that we've had problems with in the East Coast and down in Chicago. And but those attack maple trees, not pine trees. And as I said, so a very common insect. And even if the tree is healthy, if you cut it and leave the log in the forest for a couple months, these insects will
They'll
find it and
there.
Attack it. Yep.
Oh, boy. Well, we have another photo on our Facebook page from William. It's a summer photo of a fly. Beautiful.
Sure. So the metallic flies, we often call them blue bottle and green bottle flies. And there is a family of blowflies, because many of those species are associated with dead and dying animals and other decaying organic matter. But there are also some members of the housefly family that have that green metallic color. So there's a number of flies that look very similar, and it's quite common for them to be at flowers where they're either feeding on nectar or even in some cases on pollen. So the adults have a very different habit in feeding preference than the maggots, which we often associate, as I said. In fact, this is the group of flies that we use forensically a lot for guessing time of death, the blue bottle flies, because they're one of the first things to show up as an animal succumbs. So
there you go. And here's another one. This one from Carrie, I believe. Yeah, Carrie's a spider. Pretty spider.
So we had that earlier spider that was from the same family. So this is an orb weaver, but this one, because of the yellow and black, one of the names it's given is the yellow and black garden spider. I know it as Argiope or Argiope, depending how you want to pronounce the genus. There are two species that you get quite commonly. This one with that silverish thorax is the less common of the two species that I see. I think this is Trifasciatus, if I remember. But again, a big colorful spider in the late summer, and you know, you'd be inclined to scare you, but as I said, it's a family. Mm-hmm. It's just not a problem, nothing to worry about. The other thing you witness quite commonly, if you've got one out in the garden, and you know, some people will make friends with the spider, and then unfortunately they show up one day and it's gone, and it turns out there's a whole bunch of things out there whether it's birds or other insects that make their living eating spiders. And so everybody has something to deal with out there, unfortunately.
And they spin some nice webs, too.
Yeah, typical orb web, so it could be,
beautiful.
You know, 12, 15 inches in diameter, usually that very round circular thing, usually between vegetation and the like. And that's why you see out in some, you know, tall grasslands and whatnot, it's amazing how many spiders are really out there working.
Leslie in Fountain, Minnesota, up next. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I see this occasionally in the summer, and it's medium-sized butterflies like monarchs, and one is flying away carrying the other one by its wings, and I've just always wondered what is going on.
They're making more butterflies.
Okay, well, I didn't know if it was that or if they were being aggressive towards each other.
Yeah, no, I mean, males will typically kind of bump into each other in some species, they're territorial, but when they're the way insects will mate, the abdomens are attached and there's some claspers that kind of get caught sometimes, and so it isn't that unusual. In fact, some species often remain coupled for a number of hours. That's not that unusual. So, yeah, definitely it's a case of what you're seeing is just a mating process.
Okay, Well, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie, for calling, and stay listening here, because we've just this morning, Judith found a notice from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that they're considering placing the monarch butterfly under the Federal Protection of the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, the numbers are staggering, you look at. Now, it's interesting because my observations this fall, I saw more monarchs this fall than I have in the last 4 or 5 years. You know, when you're out for a walk and you see a mm-hmm. cluster of 30 or 40 adults, you know, feeding on flowers as they're traveling through. So that was slightly encouraging from a Wisconsin standpoint. But the numbers that they're showing us now is that, you know, this is the lowest population down in Mexico that they've seen in records. It's down to 35 million, which is, you know,
wow.
Their numbers were 500 million 20 years ago. And so, you know, the concern about land going into agricultural use, the use of herbicides, which are very tough on the milkweed, and then the climate changes that are going about in Mexico, which make these things very susceptible to weather patterns and the like. And so, as I said, I can see where they're coming from, is that the numbers really are a reason to be quite concerned. And the Xerces Society, who is extremely active in the preservation of invertebrates, are really the ones that are driving this. But as I said, when they show you those numbers, it's got to get your attention.
Really bad. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, he'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, weather, and then we'll be back with Phil. Stay with us. Well, no matter what the season, there are countless insects around us, and whether you're talking about wasps or butterflies or snowflies or snow fleas or spiders, I think it's always fascinating and a lot of fun to talk about. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, our guest today. Always great to have you with us, Phil. Thank you so much.
Nice to be here.
Oh, great to have you come by. And, of course, lots of people have questions about the insects that they're seeing. And certainly if you have one, you can call us at 800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page if you've got some photos. Love to see those photos. To get there, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post there. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And just to look back to the Facebook page, because there's even more. There are even more photos here. Cheryl sent us, this is a really beautiful photo.
So the family we call the wild silkworms, the Saturniids, and there are a number of species in the state. This is a female one that we call Promethea. You find it on wild cherry. The males are a little bit smaller and darker winged. Cecropia moth is another one we see. The Luna moth comes out of this group. The Polyphemus moth comes out of this group. But that's a neat picture. You know, they're more common than people think, but they don't feed as adults. They're very short-lived. The bats absolutely love them, and so they have a lot of natural predation going on. But if you're lucky enough to find one, as I said, they make great photographic. And we're talking, depending on the species, 3 to almost 5 inches in wing.
Yeah.
You know, so they're very large, and larger than most insects. In fact, they are the largest moth group that we have in the state as far as is size.
And then below it,
that's a monarch caterpillar. You know, the caterpillar of the black swallowtail looks somewhat similar, but here those long strands that stick out are quite distinctive. And this one looks like it's getting ready to start to make a chrysalis. They often get in that J shape and then kind of work it from there. So if I had to guess, this one is getting close to done feeding and getting ready to transform.
Some beautiful shots for sure. Cheryl did a wonderful job with those photos. And with lots of good photos, go to our Facebook page if you want to see the insects. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And then over on the left side, there's a column that says posts to the page. And click on that, and then these photos will all pop up and you'll get a chance to see them. You don't have to be a member of Facebook, by the way, to look at these. So. And I hope you have a chance to do it because there's lots of good photos there. Barney in Dubuque, Iowa, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. Question about box elder bugs. We built a new home about 4 years ago, and it backs up to about a 5-acre wooded site. I presume that there's some box elder trees in there, but during the hot, dry time of the year, the south and west side of our house, when it's bathed in sun, you can't even use the that side of the house for recreation because of all the box elder bugs. I mean, there's literally thousands of them. And opening a door just invites them all into the house, and we're still picking some up even this late in the year. And I'm just wondering whether or not there's some pre-emergence type application we can use around the foundation to get rid of this problem.
Well, you know, it's going to be an annual war because they're migrating in, unfortunately. And the secret is usually that early September when they start to do this clustering, and it's always on the sunny sides. So we've had good luck with soapy water solutions. And I love this story because it, you know, takes me back about 25 years ago on the show when a person called and said, I used Cheer and it didn't work, whereas what recommendation I was giving at that time was a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent, the powder, to water. But it turns out soap chemistries differ. But the dilemma with the soap is that it only kills what you spray today. So if you're comfortable with it, that's fine. And so when you get those clusters on a nice sunny morning, about 10 o'clock, you go out there with a hose attachment with some soap. And I would suggest to buy the insecticidal soap that you buy at the plant nursery stores, because I know that's got the right stuff. It doesn't have whiteners or brighteners or other things you don't need. The other side of it, though, is that there are various pyrethroid insecticides that can be applied to the side of the house. The advantage of that is it will give you upwards of about 3 weeks of knockdown, so you don't have to apply it as much. Now, if it's hard to get everything covered, you know, there are professional pest control companies that will come in, but the timing is everything. I think 1st of September is a good calendar date to start putting up your barrier. I don't want you to wait until the middle of October, because then I think many of those box elder bugs have worked up under the siding and elsewhere, and they will not be available. And those are the ones that are bothering you now. Now, a new house is often tight enough that they don't have near as much access. So, you know, maybe only 1 or 2% are making their way indoors. But again, the more you can kill outside before they get in, the better chance you have of having less problems. And in general, worry about dry late summers because their numbers stay high. If we have particularly wet late summers, there's a natural fungus disease, which is normally the thing that causes the most mortality. So wet years, box elder bugs should be less of a problem. I said, the unfortunate thing is that, you know, they could be coming from 300 yards away. So no, whatever you do this year really will not have an impact on next year. It will be more climate related as far as what their populations will be.
There you go.
Real good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Barney. Loretta in Eau Claire. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for being there. And I have a battle yearly with ladybugs and box elder bugs. Last year I had a mop bucket that was probably 14 inches square, and I had them filled up about 6 inches mm-hmm. with soapy water just to have them all covered. And I'm concerned with, okay, what happens to the dead bodies, for one?
Mm-hmm.
Does some creature get sick from, if I would put pyrethroid on or something like that?
No, pyrethroids, other than keeping away from cats, because cats don't get along with them very well, but generally are not a problem with that. But, you know, again, we go back to the best strategy is to put the defense outside, get them before they get in. Plus, we are getting much less exposure to anybody in the house if we're spraying outside rather than spraying inside. And the Asian lady beetles, it was interesting this year because the general trend for the last 10 years is their numbers have been going down in the fall. But I was in a couple places this fall, as you know, retirement allows you to kind of get out and enjoy the nice weather, where they were getting pretty nasty again as far as the numbers coming in. It was a good fall for them because it was relatively warm and lots of migration in. So, again, try to pay attention to the sunnier sides of the house because that's typically where these things will congregate. And if you have to, you err on the high side with these insects because they seem to like to crawl upwards. And so, as I said, I think the common weakness of most structures is around the windows and around the overhangs and soffits.
In the fall, I was getting like 50 ladybugs a day, and just yesterday it was 23.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, worth again to check your attic space, because that may be that where the entry point is. And then again, as we talked about, they work down through the light fixtures and other things on warm days into the house. And you know, and fine, you can kill them in the house, but you might as well just get the vacuum and take care of them that way. But I can assure you they're not breeding in the house. And that everything that you see all winter, even next spring, will trace back to what snuck in this past fall.
There you go. Thanks, Loretta.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate the call. And email from Doris in Bondiwell, who said, could you tell us what could you leave standing out in a bottle or cup with a liquid which would attract fruit flies and they drown in it?
Vinegar
mix. She wondered if a vinegar mix would work.
I mean, it's the acetic acid and whatnot seems to be attractive. Fermenting is what attracts them. But what I always warn people is, you can do this with wine, you can do it with beer. I mean, all kinds of things will draw them in and you will catch adult fruit flies. But if we're talking November, December, and you're seeing fruit flies in the house, they have to be breeding in the house. They're not coming in from outdoors. And unless you get to the source of the fruit flies, it will be a continuous process. Now, it's got to be organic, and there has to be moisture associated with it. So organic stuff that's dry will not breed fruit flies. And, you know, you can get anything from recycling cans. We find that old pumpkins and squash, I mean, something in the basement. Mm. And you don't want to think how many fruit flies you can breed from a one-pound squash.
Oh,
I mean, we're
boy.
Talking about, I'm sure, at 10,000. So as I said, it's these things that are kind of out of way that you forget about that will drive you crazy. But, too often I think people think they're just migrating in from the outside through the screens. The only time I've ever seen that is if you're canning a bunch of tomatoes and whatnot, and so there's all this just great fragrances and whatnot, fine, you can draw some in, but that's only in September when it's warm. And as I said, fruit flies are a warm, loving season type of creature. And so if you're seeing them at odd times in the house, there's something that you're not thinking about, something caked on the bottom of a garbage can, something stashed in the basement that's fueling this whole problem.
Mark and Ripon, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Through the years, wandering through the woods, especially, you know, November, December, January, I've noticed small white-winged insects that are not real big. They almost have a translucent body, it seems. And I'm just wondering what they are and what keeps them from freezing.
Well, in a lot of cases, if I had to guess, there's a group of critters we call winter moths. They're rather frail. Many of them come from a family that we call the inchworms. So those little, you know, crawly things that you see are the larval stage. And there are some that seem to be common late season. In fact, for a couple of them, they're very interesting. The females do not have wings. They are a crawling insect. And what you're seeing the males and where what you're witnessing is the mating season. And for those species, they die off. Other than the eggs that are laid in the fall. The fall cankerworm lays her eggs and a couple of the other species in November, and that's how they get through the winter and then hatch in the spring and the life cycle continues. There are a handful of species in that group, though, that can overwinter as adults. And again, this trick of what most insects have going for them is they have ways of preventing their body from forming ice. And so by super cooling is what they're doing. They can tolerate incredible temperatures, and their tissue does not get damaged because, again, there's not ice crystals. And that's the problem with ice is that the crystals will break the cells and cause them to burst. But if you don't have ice forming, you can tolerate some incredible conditions. And as I said, so, you know, they're kicking up the amount of antifreeze. They prevent ice nucleation. They've got a number of tricks, but that's what they're doing. And when you think about it, you know, many insects are predators on other insects. It's good to be out in the fall because there isn't a whole lot of predators out there. So it's a strategy that really works quite well for many of these, quote, inchworms. And as I said, if you had to give them a generic term, it's winter moth for those ones that you see in November, December. And you said even January. I know you get the right conditions and you'd be amazed at who seems to wake up.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks. Yeah, appreciate the call. And Barbara in Manitowish Waters. Kind of a favorite place of mine. Barbara, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about scale on trees. I have some black walnuts and bur oak that had thousands of scale on them last fall. I've never seen it on them before. I actually went and scraped everything off my hand rather than removing it with any chemicals of any kind because our aquifer is only 32 foot down, and it's all sand here, so I don't, whatever you use in chemicals dissipates into the aquifer within 24 hours. So I understand that ants have something to do with the spreading of the scale. Can you explain to me how I can control this or to prevent it from coming back?
Well, the thing I will tell you in the long run with native scales on native trees is that although you will get certain circumstances that they may have a high population, they will come under natural control without you doing anything. They have various wasp predators and parasites that I see show up. And so, in fact, typically when somebody has a reoccurring problem, we often ask the question, what is upsetting that natural balance? And where I've seen most of this problem is people that do a lot of mosquito fogging and whatnot on a yearly basis, that can upset. So we get more scale insects on people that use far too much mosquito treatments than people that don't. Now, where the ants play into this is that ants, when scales are feeding, they excrete a sugar water, and ants love that. And so ants are basically utilizing that as a food source. They also will protect the scale to some degree from predators, although this is not 100%. And they also, in some cases, depending on the association, it's not all scales, but some cases, the ants will literally take life stages down in the ground with them, much like they do with aphids. That's not near as common, I think, with scale as it is with some of the aphids, but ants definitely help protect them to some degree. And again, are utilizing that honeydew is getting excreted. But I'd give it a year. And one of the things that you can look at is that when the predators and parasites start to show up, if you look at that round bud-like brownish, and I think you probably have lacanium scale if I had to guess, is you will see little holes drilled in there. And what those holes are the parasites coming out. So seeing a lot of natural sign like that tells you that the natural control is kicking in. If things got excessively bad, you can use, if the timing is right, soapy water sprays. And that would probably be the least invasive method, considering your concern about the water quality issues. But as I said, my normal advice would be just let this kind of run its course, because we don't find scale populations stay high outdoors. It's the exact opposite indoors, but the argument indoors, it's not a natural system. You don't have parasites and predators helping balance the system out. So
there you go. Thanks, Barb.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Lucille in Luxembourg. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I heard a fellow talking about the box elder bugs.
Yeah.
And I accidentally solved my problem with them. We have a white garage, and my door was brown. The county was cutting down trees and grinding them up, and I asked them if I could get a load of that for mulch. And I put it around everything. It was a combination of different trees, pine and willow and white birch and whatever you have along the roadsides, you know. I spread it around my house and around my flowers, and the next day they were all gone.
Interesting.
I probably had three or four left. Mm-hmm. And then, so I had a lot of the black flies in the house. I took some and I put them in my flower pots and got rid of all my bugs in the house, too. They evidently don't like some of that kind of mulch. But it's...
You know, there's a lot of interesting chemicals in plants, and we know most of them are insecticidal or repellent to some degree, but what my concern would be is that mulch tends to dry down, the chemistry changes, and so even if we did have something that really was a great repellent, indeed, you'd wonder over time it may lose its repellency, as they said, as the chemistry of this changes. But interesting observation.
Yeah.
It's very possible, but I did this not last year, not the year before. It must be 3 years ago, and I still haven't got any.
Well, that's pretty good news.
Yes.
You wonder, you wish you knew exactly which tree.
Right.
Or maybe the combination.
Yeah, and maybe indeed they remove some of the box elder trees in the area if they're grinding on stuff, which... You know, it is a good solution if you're lucky enough to only have a few number of trees. Again, we had that previous call that talked about he had a 5-acre woods in the back. It's just not going to be feasible to go in there and cut the box elders out. And speaking of chemistry, I have to share with you some very interesting news that just kind of hit the press. Is there's been quite a bit of research in the last 4 or 5 years trying to figure out what's going on with bed bugs. And the researchers up in Canada that have been working with it now have come up with an attractant. And it took them a time to figure this out. And what's exciting about this may allow us to monitor very low numbers of bed bug infestations before people are even aware it's a problem, which makes it much easier to control. And the other thing that is really quite delightful about this combination is it's inexpensive. You know, a lot of times when you get in the chemistry of these things, it costs so much to produce them that it does not feasible. From what they're saying is it appears that we're talking just a few cents worth of chemical in the trap will work. And so stay tuned to this. It will not eliminate it. But boy, if we can put the fires out before they get going, this is really quite interesting. And as I said, I remember hearing some of this research 3 or 4 years ago, but they finally got the combination together, as I said, that we think we've got a good understanding that we can put something in a cardboard trap and we will draw them in from the areas around them,
as I said,
which will help reduce the populations, but more importantly, allow us to capture or be aware that we got a problem well before we're seeing anything other outward signs.
We have, that is very good news, and more good news on the photo front if we go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And again, somebody's wondering, I can't see those photos. If you go to, on the left side of the page, there's something, there's a headline that says posts to page. And if you click on that, you're going to, the photos are going to pop up for you. And here we have, kind of a nice shot here from Mary.
The best mosquito eating machine there is out there. It doesn't get the credit, but this is a dragonfly in particular. This is a green darner, Anax junius, which is really the largest common dragonfly that we get here. Their color changes depending on their maturity, and so you get some blues in them also. A very neat photographic subject, and as I said, they make their way feeding on small flies and gnats, which includes mosquitoes. And I've always said Dr. Craven won't agree with me, but they deserve much better press than the Purple Martins. That's my side of the story.
There you go. And here's another shot. This one from Chris. What do we got here? Boy, this is pretty.
Yeah, there's two critters there. One is a flower spider, or it's from a group that we call the crab spiders, but there's a subgroup that are very colorful. They're often given the name flower spiders.
The yellow one here?
The yellow one with the pink stripes on it. They often will sit on flowers waiting for prey to come by. And from what I can tell, that looks like a plume moth that is next to it. Plume moths have these very feathery antennae. They're rather small, but if you get one with the wings spread out, they're very interesting design creatures. That's just an adult plume moth. That would be my guess. I wish I could see it dorsally from the top, but you would expect that to be in that environment, and it wouldn't surprise me if the spider can turn around quickly that it will have something to feed on tonight.
Well, Phil, it's always a pleasure. We've had probably 12 visits the last year.
Yeah, it seems to be about once a month, so I'm doing okay in retirement.
Yeah, you are, and it's great to have you, and we'll see you in 2015.
Yes, and then I'm going to start dragging my replacement in to help share, because PJ is doing a great job over there in the lab, and I think he'd give us some interesting perspective on some of the things he's picking up.
All right, and you mentioned Scott Craven. He joins me tomorrow, so Scott Craven will be with us tomorrow to talk about the world of wildlife. In the meantime, thanks so much to Phil Pelletieri, and thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow. Great show tomorrow as well on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.